So just give me a little, before we talk about class and the American status system, just tell me a little bit about yourself so I have a picture of you.
Right. Well, the book has surprised many people because I've written, this is my eighth book, and most of the others have been pretty serious. They've been books of literary cultural criticism, books of history, books about modern European history. I wrote a book about the First World War, for example, that was some notice was paid to a few years ago. So people got the idea that I was a very solemn chap and very serious. So when I brought out this book, which I see as a comic book, and it's very frivolous and outrageous and funny, and it's a sort of game everybody can play, a lot of people were kind of astonished. But I think there's no reason to be astonished because, you know, if one's medium is language, one can use it for all kinds of things. And that's, you know, that's what my explanation of myself. I was born into, I would call it the upper middle class in Pasadena, California, which I despised. I fled there years ago to come to the graduate school at Harvard University. I've been in the East Coast ever since the late 1940s, and I have been teaching English to students at Rutgers University for 28 years. And that's my scene. But I've been living in Princeton, which gives one a special insight, I think, into the class situation in this country. I've been teaching at a state university, which I've enjoyed very much. And I've been living in an upper middle class or upper class suburb, which I've liked very much. So I've had to sort of try to understand my own attitudes towards these things. And that's how I got interested in writing the book Class.
I wasn't sure what to wear when you came in. I was afraid.
That is a problem.
Well, I was afraid that my lapels were going to be too wide and that my collar would hook up over my shirt.
Well, it has less to do with clothes than most people think. It has much more to do with what I'd call loose carriage or relaxation, the feeling starting from the gut that you're okay, that nobody's going to laugh at you or ridicule you because you've got the wrong clothes or something.
I don't know. You know, remember all the pictures of Richard Nixon? He would be doing news conferences, but he would always stand.
Yeah, I know.
His shoulders a little hunched and his collar always raising above his shirt collar.
He never learned how to wear clothes, Nixon, and that's a sort of middle-class sign, alas. In the book, I lay some emphasis upon the costumes of the president, running from Nixon all the way up finally to the incumbent. And I'm afraid I'm not very courteous about any of them. I think they're largely a set of jokers, especially when they come on in business suits and try to look like the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, which they're visibly not. The incumbent interests me a lot because he's dressing in such a way as to get maximum applause from the sort of sunbelt Philistines who elected him. Hence the acrylic shirts of the Windsor tie knot and the excessively padded shoulders, not to mention the dyed hair, the rouge, and so on. I ask in the book, actually, and it's amazing how little criticism that president gets. I don't know why. I think it may be because he was shot at so early in his career and everybody's sorry for him, as they should be. I ask in the book frivolously how soon it will be before he proceeds to eyeshadow. I mean, since he comes on a rouge all the time now. Well, that's sort of the speculations I make about the presidents. The presidents are very interesting in a class point of view. If you're interested in clothes and in physical presentation, because they're obliged to be television stars, whether they want to or not, and they have to stand up there, and they have to be authentic, they have to be plausible, and they have to make people like them and admire them, and they have to do it very largely, since none of them can say anything except terrible cliches and banalities, such as the nature of the job, they have to do it by posture and by gesture and by clothes. So their costumes repay deep study, I think, if you're interested in anthropology.
I want to ask you about some of the other points that you make in class, but the book came out at a very interesting time because a couple of weeks ago I head into the studio, sitting in the same chair that you're sitting in, an American writer who lives in London by the name of Paul Theroux.
Yes, yes.
His new book deals with the British, primarily the English, a book called Kingdom at Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet.
I know about it, yeah. He wandered around the coastline.
Yes, he did.
And sort of deplored it.
He goes into a great amount of detail about the British class system,
mm-hmm.
which is very pronounced there. One of the reasons that the British are reluctant to speak to people, strangers, is that when they open their mouths, they reveal their class in society.
Yeah, the British are interesting to the degree that they know that that's true. It happens in the United States, too, only here people don't know it as intimately as the British not. I think everybody in this country knows roughly what class the person they're talking to is the minute any conversation occurs. For example, you and I are not dropping the G's on our present participles. We're not saying speaking of this. We're saying speaking of this. This instantly identifies ourselves as middle class or above. If we were what I call proles in the book, that is high, middle, or low proletarians, we'd be very tempted to drop the G and as well to use the double negative or to use sort of ostentatiously comical sort of adolescent grammar like he don't get it, stuff like that, which instantly is a class signal. It's partly a defensive class signal. And if you're talking to a pro, he wants to signal to you right away that he is not in your class so that embarrassment won't result. So you won't ask him what he thinks of the Newport Yacht Race, for example, which would embarrass him because he's never heard of it or has no interest in it. Or you might ask him, you know, did you have a nice summer in Nantucket? Then he'd have to confess that he went to Epcot Center or something. So knowing about people's classes is really a very kind way of avoiding embarrassment. As I say in the book, you know you're talking to a member of your own class, whether you like the idea of a class system or not, if you don't have to explicate your references. If when you talk about the Century Club, or if when you talk about the Brown Derby, you don't have to carefully explain a men's club in New York or a flashy restaurant on Wilshire Boulevard in California.
You said something interesting a moment ago. You said that Americans are not aware of their class as the English tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it also true that most Americans don't care? That most Americans of a prole disposition
mm-hmm.
are feel just as equal to somebody of the highest out of sight, I think you phrased them in the book.
That's a good point, and I think it's true about the proletarians. I don't think it's true in the middle class. I think the middle class in this country can be defined by its relative unhappiness in that position and its constant aspiration to rise by various devices, buying classy things from catalogs, buying cars above its means, taking in the New Yorker, buying things from the Neiman Marcus catalog, all that is middle-class behavior, and I think that indicates a pathetic and deep desire of the middle class, at least, to express its aspirations to move up one rung and move up to what the Preppy Handbook beautifully calls the preppy classes, or the upper middle class.
Well, I was looking around my apartment the other night after reading the book. I don't know if you had a point. I think you have a point system for home furnishings, don't you?
Yeah.
And I think you gave 8 points for a bookshelf, as I recall, something of that nature.
Yeah, if it's full of books,
If it's full of books.
Yeah.
So I was looking around my Manhattan apartment on the west side in a not a very classy neighborhood. It's on Columbus Avenue. But I was looking around my apartment trying to think where my house fit in to your notion of home furnishings. And, of course, I had many points because I have floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. But then I happened to notice that I have a large Sony television set with a videotape recorder which rather dominates the living room.
Well,
and I thought that all of the point structure that I had built for myself suddenly began to collapse.
Yes, but you might be saved, because if there's no other room to put the television in...
Oh, thank God.
...then you're okay. I'll make a confession. I keep mine in my living room, too, because I have no other room for it. But I'm very careful to disarm it and to take away from some of its bad class implications by putting ridiculous things on it to indicate that I'm not taking it seriously. I have a bizarrely ugly clock on top of it and things like that. Just to say, I am not believing in this instrument, although I use it constantly, of course.
I approach it a little bit differently, Paul. What I have a videotape machine, and I always say, I never watch television. I only watch videotapes.
Yeah, well, that's very classy. It's even more classy not to watch videotapes at all.
Well, let's look at a couple of things here about. We addressed appearance.
Mm-hmm.
We addressed. The house. Let's look at recreation.
Okay.
Page 97.
Recreation. Now, the fascinating thing about recreation is that you can measure your class to a degree by whether the sports you like to watch and like to imagine involve deep body contact, like pro football or hockey. The more body contact, the lower, which is what makes tennis a very high sport and makes yacht racing an even higher sport. The less body contact, the better. There's another amusing criterion, I think, of a class sport, and that is that it's one played with very small balls. Golf and tennis are therefore classier than, say, soccer, football, or bowling.
Bowling, because it uses this great big heavy ball, is preeminently the proletarian sport. If you have two guys who have the same amount of money, the same income, say, and they have 2 hours off in the middle of the day, and one plays squash and the other goes bowling, you can instantly understand the class difference between them. And furthermore, you can understand that class doesn't have all that much to do with income. It has to do with taste and styles and the kind of act that you play. You can do that with a lot of money or a little bit. A lot of people who have the same amount of money play very different class styles.
Food and beverages.
Okay, here the general principle is that sweet is low. Sweet is low. The sweeter your drinks, the lower your class in general. And the higher your class, the more dry you'll insist that your white wine be. I mean, Puy Fuissé is all right, but Chablis, if it's very dry, is even better. The classiest thing really is not to drink at all, but to drink Perrier water, perhaps with a little lime or lemon. And that presupposes that you're very sensible, that you used to drink, but that you've given it up as stupid and wasteful, and that now you've reformed and you're very bright and very disciplined. In food, it's hard to generalize about food. You can't generalize about the time you eat, actually. The earlier you eat, the lower your class. If you eat at 6, that's generally a pearl dining hour. 6:30 to 7, 7:30 is middle class. 7:30 to 8:30 is upper middle. And as I pointed out in the book, sometimes the upper classes drink so much that they don't bother to eat at all.
Isn't it true that one who is aware of his class is really aware of what other people think of him?
Yeah, he is, and it can create great anxiety, especially in this country where everybody is impelled to think he's making it all the time. I mean, where nobody really inherits a position in this country. You have to earn it, or at least you have to claim it. And consequently, everybody is, to a degree, status anxious here, the way they're not in England, for example, where you might be born into a class. You can't get out of it as easily as you can here. You can't fake it as easily as you can here. I think there's a lot of status anxiety here. Go ahead. I forgot the question.
Opened a can of worms by raising these class differences in America, which has traditionally been known for a classless society?
Yeah, I suppose so, but it never has been a classless society. And I think it's useful to point to things that other people don't notice. Or that if they do notice, they conspire not to talk about. I love to talk about embarrassing things that strike me as important. I think the class system is important. I think a lot of people fail in this country because they don't realize the degree to which they are determined by their class background. They think that money is going to get them out of it. Well, it won't. You know, if you still can't construct a witty paragraph in public, you're lost. If you want to go to law school or if you want to run in the Senate or do something. It's awful. And people don't know this. So I think one performs a public service, cruel as it may appear, to call attention to the class situation and to try to measure, you know, some of its more subtle contours.
What about education? I would assume that one who goes to a state university, mm-hmm. like Rutgers, mm-hmm. would be of a different class than one who goes to Princeton or Penn.
Well, not necessarily, because that's all kind of mixed up. But I think it's important for students going to those places to know that they're not equal. They're not equal. And that there are many more scholarships at Penn and Princeton than there are at Rutgers, for example. There's much more personal tuition, personal attention. The school costs a lot more. They're more expensive, and you get pretty much what you pay for. Now, not to know that is to be a fool, although there's nothing whatever wrong with people going to any university they can get into and doing as well as they can there. They should know where they are and what they're doing. That's my point. When I taught at Rutgers, I knew what I was doing. You know, I was teaching at a big state university. I was teaching classes of 30 and 40 students, and it was mass education. If one thinks it's personal education, one's deceiving oneself, whether you're a teacher or a student. So the real point about talking about class and education is to persuade people that it's important to know where they are and what they're doing. Somebody who goes to Kutztown State should not imagine that he's going to Amherst. There's a great crucial difference between them. At Amherst, you get deep personal instruction. You will know your professor very well. You will have dinner with him and so on, something that will never happen at a big state university. I just want people to know where they are. I think that's
the first thing that the authorities at Kutztown State should do would be to change the name.
Yeah,
that in itself would help, because names are extremely, extremely important.
They are, and that was another thing I'm warning people about in this book, especially parents of college-age kids, is don't be deceived by the names. The fact that an institution calls itself a university doesn't mean it's a university. It may be a teacher's college, it may be a business school, it may be a theological seminary. Find out and try to get some good advice from professionals, not just one or two, but a whole lot of them. It'll save you money. It'll save your kid a lot of agony in the long run.
Didn't you say somewhere in the book that some of these phony diploma mills on the West Coast have British-sounding names like Winston University?
Yeah, one of them, Kensington University, is one I like. It's an immense amount of snobbery, of course, in education. And I've written a lot about that in the book, about the kind of snobbery which attends the whole higher educational apparatus in this country and which has almost nothing to do with actual learning. This is one of the sad things about this country. We don't have a peerage. We don't have a set of classy regiments to belong to. We have only the system of higher education for snobbish purposes. So if somebody really wants to make it, he will advertise for the rest of his life that he went to Yale, Harvard, or Princeton.
I don't think I was, until now at least, I don't think I've been particularly conscious of class, but I remember back when I was going to college, one of my journalism professors warned us all that when you get out in the great wide world, you will realize that two-thirds of all of the people who live in this country are dullards. And, of course, I couldn't imagine that. I mean, there's the postman, there's the fireman.
Mm-hmm.
How could they be dullards?
Mm-hmm.
And I still wonder about that, but I have a feeling after being out of school now for 25 years that he may have been right.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure it isn't kind of cruelly mistaken to put it that way. Sometimes I think 99% of them are dullards. But then I rethink myself, and I kind of say, well, God, if they are, so am I. Because, you know, I like television, I like radio, I like magazines, I like sports, I like the things they do. And I also like to read, you know, Henry James and James Joyce and Samuel Johnson and Jonathan Swift and Shakespeare and all kinds of other things. And listen to Vivaldi and all that stuff. I think the aim here, if one wants to escape this sort of class determinism, is to be as interested in as many things as possible and not be worried about what somebody's going to think of you because you exercise your curiosity, because you're as interested in pro football as you're interested in, European church history of the 17th century, which is as interesting as football, as a matter of fact, once you get into it.
Before I ask my last question, I want to tell you a little story, an incident that happened here on the 16th floor yesterday. I did an interview with Canada's best-known author, a man by the name of Mordecai Richler, probably best known for a novel called The Apprenticeship of Duddy Krevitz.
Yep.
Mordecai is in New York to promote an anthology of humor that he edited, and also to work on the book for a Broadway musical, which is going to be known as Duddy. Mordecai came in yesterday morning by himself. The coffee machine down here, or the coffee maker, had been turned off, so I ran upstairs and I got Mordecai a cup of coffee, brought it back down to him. We came in just as you did, sat here, and we chatted just as you and I did. I help Mordecai with his coat, and we go out to the elevator bank, escort him onto the elevator. As we do, the door opens, and a large number of people come rushing out. It must be 20 people. Led by Muhammad Ali, an entourage of 20 people, followed by a CBS photographer.
Mm-hmm.
He comes flowing into the newsroom, photographer taking pictures. Girls come running down the hall with scraps of paper for Muhammad Ali to sign. One of the office girls, for some reason, had a camera. Maybe she knew he was coming. They rush him in. He does it about 10 minutes live on the air. Apparently he's doing something with regard to world hunger.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly what that is, but something to figure out world hunger. Has a commercial tie-in as well. And then they do a tape, a 30-minute broadcast for one of our weekend ghetto shows.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I am saying goodbye to Mordecai Richler.
Whom nobody recognizes.
Nobody came down asking for his autograph,
just
except me.
Yeah.
I asked him to sign his book.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody took his picture. He had no entourage of 20 people. And yet here's Muhammad Ali signing autographs with his ex.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about class now. I mean, here is certainly a class difference of two different types of personality in a different way that everybody except me saw them.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you an instant diagnosis. I mean, it won't surprise anybody to hear me announce that Muhammad Ali is a pro. There's no question about that, just like Frank Sinatra. No matter how much money they make and how fine the suits are that they get made for them, they remain pros. I would say that the Rickler Ali confrontation there, or juxtaposition, makes this point that understatement is class. Overstatement is always vulgar, no matter who does it, no matter how much money. This is why in the book, frivolously but still rather seriously, I make the point that the classiest car you can have is not a Mercedes, not a Rolls-Royce, but a Ford, especially if it's rather dusty, and if you don't pay any attention to showing off. And showing off is vulgar. Being attended with an entourage is easy, obvious, and cheap.
Do you know what kind of and what color car Muhammad Ali drives? Or at least I saw him about a year and a half ago.
White.
No. He drives a Rolls-Royce convertible. Would you like to take a guess about the color?
Purple.
Lavender.
Okay.
My last question. Of course, you've stirred up a hornet's nest mm-hmm. with this book that's had quite a bit of press and a lot of respectful reviews. What has this done to your personal life?
Nothing, whatever.
Are people afraid to invite you over because the wine may be too sweet?
No, they always were, as a matter of fact, because everybody I know has known that I've been writing this book for 5 or 6 years, and I've interviewed veterinarians about class in dogs. I've interviewed flower people about class in flowers. I've interviewed a lot of my women friends about class in women's clothes, and so on. It's been public knowledge that I've been writing this book, and nobody's really very scared, partly because they know that it's funny, you know, and no one's going to be hurt by this book. You're going to be hurt by this book just about as much as you would be hurt by the satire in an Al Cap cartoon. You know, if you don't have a sense of humor, you better not buy this book. That would be my deep commercial advice to everybody.
Why are you smiling on the back of the book?
That's a good question. It was a very cold day, and the photography caught me in a moment when I wasn't very happy.
It's a wonderful book. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you,
Don. Thank you for coming in.